Sairam, and a warm good morning from Prashanthi Nilayam, dear listeners. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I welcome you to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show where you can drop your questions on practical applications on Swami's message to our day-to-day problems, confusions and decisions, and I will offer answers based on Swami's message. Well, that's what I say, but sometimes I do get abstract philosophical questions too. And I do feature them on the show at times because that way it gives us an opportunity to explore what Swami has said on these topics. There are all kinds of philosophical explanations out in the public domain today, and I think we all have the tendency of filling our heads with all of that, and that eventually leads to what Swami would say, intellectual indigestion. So for the purpose of clearing this indigestion in the mind, it is good to turn to Swami's message and see what is Swami's stance on some of these topics. But there is a prerequisite for this act to lead to clarity. And that is, we must have faith in Swami's words. Our love and acceptance of Swami as supreme should lead our rational. Otherwise, what we read in discourses will only become another perspective and will just add to our confusion which is already there. There are people who have respect and reverence for Swami as probably just another guru or a holy man. Well, I'm not referring to them. I'm referring to those among us who believe Swami is divine, who believe Swami is an incarnation, or even those who have accepted Swami as their Sadguru. Faith in Swami's words becomes very, very important. So why did I go into that philosophical reverie about abstract concepts and how we must read into Swami's message? Because today I have one such question about a concept and what Swami has to say about it. But let me come to it when it is time for the question. For now, it is time for the quote of the week. The quote I'm going to read out today is from one who epitomizes the vigor, valor and vivacity of spirituality and youth. It's none other than Swami Vivekananda. And I quote, "The greatest force is derived from the power of thought. The finer the element, the more powerful it is. The silent power of thought influences people even at a distance, because mind is one as well as many. The universe is a cobweb. Minds are spiders." End of quote. Wow, isn't that a powerful quote? You know, oftentimes we may wonder, why is it really necessary to control the mind or even try to do that? We have no control over the thoughts that come into our mind. They keep coming and going. Why bother about them? Though this approach is right at one level, we must still lead life in such a way and perform sadhana that eventually enables us to have only certain types of thoughts. The reason is this: each thought is so powerful. As Swami says, the whole world, what we see and live in, is created through our sankalpas and vikalpas, thoughts and our reactions. Our fears create a fearful world. Our noble thoughts create a noble world. We may wonder, how can my thoughts influence the whole world? But isn't it true that we create our own worlds? How is it that two people living in the same home see life differently? There are two people in the same situation, but one is positive and the other is negative. And the way they see the world is completely different. And that makes their world completely different, isn't it? That being one aspect, Swami Vivekananda says in that quote that the finger, the finer the thoughts are, the more powerful they become. What does he mean by fine? I would believe that he means that thoughts must become selfless. But when I say selfless, it does not mean self-abnegation. That could at best be a beginning, but true selflessness is when we start giving up body consciousness. When the thoughts we have arise from not body consciousness, but as Swami would say, atmabhimanam or atmic consciousness. There's a very interesting study in neuroscience which I'll definitely not go into today, because if I do, I will end up speaking on it for the next 1 hour. That study suggests that just like how one neuron in our brain communicates to another neuron in the brain, the neurons in our brain also have the ability to communicate with the neurons in another person's brain, which literally means I can simply sit here and read the thoughts of the person in front of me, And the study suggests that every brain does this to some extent, but it is of course limited. Some people may develop siddhis or some techniques through which this can be consciously done. But there is another natural way in which this will happen. If our mind starts giving up this idea that I am this body and mind alone, then this will happen. As our consciousness expands, as we give up body consciousness, the mind literally gets freed from me, this idea of me and I, this personality. And the individual mind starts recognizing its oneness with the universal mind. And that's what Vivekananda says in that quote, the mind can influence even those that are at a distance, for it is one and it is many. And what a beautiful analogy he gives in the end. The whole universe then becomes like a cobweb and the minds are like spiders. I recall once Swami had himself explained this. Swami had given a discourse on philosophy and apparently he had quoted extensively from ancient philosophers and even modern and Western philosophers. At the end of the discourse, I think it was Professor Gokak who went up to Swami and said, Swami, when did you read all this? How did you know the names of so many philosophers? And Swami said, Gokak, I don't have the bad habit of reading books. And then he laughed. But well, then he explained. Swami didn't say that I'm God, I'm omniscient, so I know everything, which of course would have been a right answer to give. But Swami said the human mind has in it the ability to reach out to every knowledge that is available in the universe. But most people are not aware of it. That's what Swami said. And that's what Swami Vivekananda explained in that quote, which permit me to read out once again before we move on to the question for this week. I quote, the greatest force is derived from the power of thought. The finer the element, the more powerful it is. The silent power of thought influences people even at a distance, because mind is one as well as many. The universe is a cobweb, minds are spiders. So let's head to the question for this week. The question this week has come from an elderly gentleman who wishes to remain anonymous, so I will not mention his name. There are actually a couple of questions, a few of them, but I'll read them out myself. I have a question to ask you. I wonder whether Swami has ever mentioned about this in his discourses. And the question is, after death, what happens to the Atma that was residing in the body? Where does it go? How long does it take to enter into a new suitable body? Is there always a rebirth? Does anyone escape rebirth? Does this Atma merge into the Supreme Consciousness? Is this Supreme Consciousness Shiva or Narayana or formless, attributeless reality? Is it good to worship the souls of our parents or son for any help in case the son has died under tragic circumstances? But then suppose they have taken a rebirth, then what will happen to our prayers? Well, there are a lot of questions there, but as you can see, the theme behind all of them is what happens to a person after he discards his mortal body. And does he merge? Does he come back into a body? How long does it take? So all of that is about what happens after death. Well, you know, many times the people who come and ask me that you speak about concepts such as, you know, how do you lead a harmonious married life and things like that, and you don't have experience in all of that, and how can you give advice about all of that? Well, I think this question beats all of that. Here's a question that asks me what happens after death. So there is absolutely no practical knowledge from which I'm going to answer this question. But the fact is, there is no question on the show which I actually answer through practical understanding. It is all what Swami has told us. It is just a collation of what Swami has told in different places in his discourses and in his writings. Right? So to this question, Has Swami spoken about it in his discourses? Of course he has. In fact, there are many, many Samakosh discourses where Swami has mentioned about these concepts. There are some Vahinis in which Swami has written extensively about it. But of course, it may not be in one place. There's no one particular discourse or book which you can read about and come to the understanding of what all of this. But I'll try to explain a little of what Swami has said so that you can get a clear understanding of what is Swami's explanation, of course, which is the ultimate explanation for some of these questions. But before beginning the answer, I would like to make three points. Point one, I'm not going to be talking about ghosts, spirits, disembodied bodies and so on. Not in this answer or not in the answer to any question in the future. So please do not ask me about them. Don't send me questions regarding that. Because Swami does not speak much about these. And really speaking, for a normal spiritual life, for a life of a spiritual aspirant, you know, we really do not need to know some of these things, because these are, first of all, as Swami would say, much of it, what we call ghosts and spirits, are all imaginations. There's some reality to it, but there is so much of confusion in that. And actually speaking, we really don't need to worry about that or go into that. So we will not be going into that even in this answer. I'm not going to be talking about that. The second point, when we're talking about death and life, we are going to be talking about life and death in the earthly plane, right? We are not going to be talking about different lokas, which many scriptures in the Indian culture refer to. Maybe towards the end, I'll make a mention of why this does not figure into our explanation of birth and death. But for now, I will not be talking about them. These are actually, Swami says, different levels of existence. They're all true. They may not be similar to the way we understand it, you know, as we see in our movies and our serials, where there are these lokas in the clouds and there are people dressed in a certain way. No, it's not necessarily like that. But in these different planes, what we call death is different, what we call fear is different, what we call desire is different. So we will not bring that into the answer because it's going to complicate the whole thing. So we will avoid that completely too. The third point I want to make is, I want to explain this word which was used even in this question. You know, what happens to the person after he dies? Where does the Atma go? So I would like to explain a little about this word or this terminology called Atma, because much of our doubt arises because we do not understand that this word can be used in multiple contexts, right? It's not always, when we say Atma, it's not always that Brahman or that divinity which Swami refers to. This word Atma is widely used in two contexts, right? And both of these come from the actual word which refers to that particular term. For instance, one is Paramatma and the other is Jivatma. Where Paramatma is the supreme, the Brahman or the divine aspect. The Jivatma is the spark of the divine, or each, all of us are supposed to be individual souls, Jivatmas, right? Since the word Atma appears in Paramatma and Jivatma, we end up using these two words in both contexts, which leads to a certain amount of confusion. The interchangeably using of these two words for these two different ideas of Paramatma and Jivatma is what leads to a lot of confusion. For instance, you know, when we use the word, when we use terms like Atma Tripti, let us do it for self-satisfaction. If we use the word Atma Tripti, here the Atma actually means the Jivatma, or to suggest that we should do it for self-satisfaction. Because really speaking, the Atma has nothing like satisfaction or displeasure or like or dislike or something. The Atma is always in a state of bliss and it does not have any desires whatsoever. So when we say Atma Tripti, now this Atma refers to what we call the Jivatma, and so it means self-satisfaction. Or what, when you say words like Atma Samman, which means self-respect. Again, the real Atman, the Brahman, is beyond respect and beyond derision and all of that. So when we say self-respect, we mean giving respect to this individual personality that we are referring to as me or I or whatever it is. So in that sense, keep this in mind that when we say the Atma leaves the body, what we are referring to is actually the Jivatma. Because that Atma, which is absolutely divine, what we probably just for the sake of clarity, let's use the word Atman instead of Atma. Right? That Atman, which is Brahman, which is divine, Swami says that that is omniscient. I'm sorry, is omnipresent, which means that there is no place or object in which that divine aspect is not there. So to this question of, there is this particular beautiful dialogue which is there in one of Swami's Vahinis, I think Prashnotra Vahini or Sandeha Nivarani, where the devotee asks Swami that, is God there even in a dead body? And Swami says, of course, God is there in every inanimate object, in this table and this chair and all of these. So in that sense, certainly God is present even in a dead body, which means that Atman, that Brahman principle is present even in a dead body. It is not that Atman which leaves the body. It is this Jivatma which actually leaves the body. Right? So that is something that we'll have to keep in mind. So with these three points, let me go on to the answer. So what happens after death? Who leaves the body? And when and how does one re-enter another body, right? Well, to understand this, there are two points which I'd like to make. One thing is, there is a striking similarity between what happens to us when we go to sleep every day and what happens to us when we eventually die, when our life term ends and we discard our body. That is one point. And the other thing is, to understand this concept of birth and death according to Vedanta, according to what Swami's explanations are, every explanation which Swami has given in this regard, and of course in every other regard, is very, very strongly rooted in the Vedantic wisdom. So if you want to understand what happens to the body according to the Vedantic understanding of our sages and saints, then you will have to understand or look into the concept called the three bodies that we all are. And these three bodies are, in Sanskrit, they are called Stula Sharira, Sukshma Sharira, and Karana Sharira. And this theme is central to this understanding, not only about this concept of what happens to the soul after death, but to the entire idea of what happens in the name of creation. What happens when God created the beings in earth. So this concept of the three bodies, the Stula, Sukshma and the Karana, is very, very central and important to understand. Let me explain each one of these bodies and what they stand for. The Stula Sharira means the gross body. The gross body literally means that body which is absolutely made of that which we can see. The body which is made of flesh, bones, blood, the nerve cells and all of that put together, what we see as the body. What is left behind when a person dies, I think that would be a good way of explaining that, is what we refer to as the Stula Sharira, the gross body. And that body is absolutely inanimate. It does not have any sentience of its own. It cannot do anything of its own. It cannot even move from one place to the other. It is as good as probably a block of wood which you place in front of you. It cannot do anything. You will have to move it if you wanted to move from one place to the other. That is what we refer to as the gross body. So who moves this body around? Who animates this body which is actually lifeless? And that would be the second body, which is what we refer to as the sukshma sharira, or the subtle body. This is what literally animates this inanimate gross body. And this is a very complex thing that we'll have to understand. The sukshma sharira is made up of multiple things and it operates in multiple levels. When we are awake, this sukshma sharira is made up of our thoughts, our emotions, our fears, our desires and all of this, and our responses. And we're talking to somebody, that person says something, you know, what makes those words mean a certain thing? Somebody is speaking to us loudly. What makes us feel that that person is speaking harshly to us? Or somebody comes and holds a hand. What makes us feel that this is a gesture of love? Physically, these are nothing but gestures. These are just but two inanimate bodies interacting with each other. But what makes us feel that this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is loving, this is harsh, is all because of these thoughts and emotions in our mind. And this is nothing but the subtle world when we are awake, Right? Keep that in mind. This is the subtle world when we are awake. So this subtle body, through its, first of all, thoughts, feelings and all of these, animates the body. And how does it operate? To operate it, it uses what we refer to as the pranas, right? The life forces. It uses the life forces to keep this body alive and animated. And it uses what we refer to as the senses, which are the jnanendriyas. Because when we say the senses belong to the subtle body, the eye, the ear, the skin, all of that remains when a person dies, right? But that person cannot see, that person cannot hear, that person cannot feel the sense of touch. That is because the faculty of senses, of sight, of hearing, has been removed from that body. Because these, the faculties of sight, of hearing, of speech, of movement, all of this belong to the subtle body, right? So this subtle body is very complex in that sense. It contains the life force, it contains the senses, it contains the thoughts and feelings. So this is only that part which we use when we are awake. But deep within the subtle body also contains the information about all our past lives, which means our journey from the beginning till the end. We know why we are at this point, what are we suffering, all our past impressions and experiences, all of that is also added together and is present in the subtle body. But the thing is, when we are awake, I spoke about being conscious to the body, being body conscious in the introduction. So Vedanta says that when we are awake, we are so attached to this body that our mind constantly thinks that I am this body. And when this body moves around, you say that I am moving around. When the body is hungry, you say I am hungry. When the body is hurt, you say I am hurt. So there is this very, very strong connection between the mind and the body, because of which the subtle body almost buries deep in it all the memories of the past lives. It does not have the ability to access all of these past experiences because it is so much involved with that body it is living in at that very moment, right? So this is actually the role of the subtle body when awake. But Swami goes on to say that the subtle body becomes even more powerful when we go to sleep, that is, in the dream state. And the process, the way it happens, is very, very fascinating. Swami says, when we go to sleep, when we enter into the dream state, what does the subtle body do? It withdraws the senses into itself. The subtle body withdraws the senses into itself, but leaves the prana alone in the body. So you have the gross body there lying on the bed, and the prana, the life force, is allowed to remain in the body, so that the body is kept alive. But all the senses, the feelings, the fears, the thoughts, the emotions, all of that is drawn back into the subtle body. And Swami says that in the dream state, this subtle body, now since it is not bound by the body, which means it is not bound by time and space, now in the dream state, it has the ability to create a world of its own. It creates a completely different world, and that's why we, you know, in our dream we see all kinds of things. And Swami also says that there is no logic in a dream. There is no time and space in a dream. That, you know, you think that you're traveling from here to USA. One moment in the dream you're here, the next moment you're in USA. And all of this happens in a span of 4 minutes when you're sleeping. This is because the created the world, the subtle world creates a world, the subtle body, I'm sorry, creates a world which is not bound by time and space. And in this world, the subtle body starts, Swami says, one thing is from the waking state, all the fears and of all the problems, like if you've gone through a tough day at work, you start dreaming about that, of the boss shouting at you, or if you've had something, a pleasant experience in your wakeful state, that starts replaying in the mind. And added to that, the subtle body also brings up experiences from past lives, and that also mingles with the experiences of the present world, and it creates this subtle dream world, right? So this dream world is where the subtle body is completely active. It has withdrawn its senses from the body, which means it has withdrawn from the limitations of the body, and now it is in a state where it can completely go around. But the only thing is, the subtle world cannot influence much in the physical world. So if the subtle body really wants to do something, it will have to again animate this gross body and then have work done through the gross body. So this is about the dream state. And then Swami says that when we go to sleep after the dream, we go into what is called the deep sleep state. And this is where the third body, which I mentioned, comes into play, which is Karana Sharira. The first one is Thula Sharira, which means the gross body. The second one is Sukshma Sharira, which means the subtle body. The third one is what Swami refers to as the Karana Sharira, which literally translated means the causal body. The body which has a complete knowledge of what this being is going through the many, many births it is traveling. It is the Karana Sharira. I will come back to this a little when I'm talking about death, because this is where what Swami says is very important. So this Karana Sharira, in the context of Vedanta, you know, when we talk about the gross body, we're talking about the body which is made up of the five elements, which is made up of food. When you're talking about the subtle body, we're talking about the body which is luminescent, which is made up of thoughts, which is made up of feelings, right? And the pranas, of course, the life force. But when you're talking about the Karana Sharira, its nature is actually bliss. Its nature is nothing but unqualified bliss. And the mind, the subtle body, will have no means of explaining what the Karana Sharira is. And they say that is why, in words, I will not be able to explain to you what is the state of the Karana Sharira. Because the experience of the Karana Sharira is beyond the dream state as well as the wakeful state. That is why when we go to sleep, you go into a deep sleep state. The deep sleep state, or Sushupti, is referred to as the state of the Karana Sharira. When we wake up, we will never know what it felt like to be in deep sleep. We only know that it was very pleasant, it was very refreshing. We can only say in the morning that, oh, I had a very good sleep. But we will not be able to describe what happened to us, this feeling of me, this feeling of I, when we were going through that deep sleep state. Because just as during the dream state, the senses are withdrawn into the Sukshma Sharira, in the deep sleep state, the senses and the mind are now withdrawn into the Karana Sharira. It is literally subsumed into the Karana Sharira. And in that state, you do not have the ability to experience what it is, or you do not have the ability to come out of it and say this is what it felt like. Right? So this is what happens when we undergo, every night when we go to sleep, this is what literally happens. From the physical state, which represents the Sthula Sharira, from the dream state, which represents the Sukshma Sharira, to the state of the deep sleep, where it represents what we refer to as the Karana Sharira. Now, coming to what happens exactly when we die, in what way is different when we die and when we go to sleep? The simplest difference, as I can tell you, is every morning we wake up into the same body, right? This whole process reverses itself. From the Karana Sharira, the subtle body emerges. From the subtle body, the senses emerge and then start animating the gross body. This is what happens. So every day we wake up into this same body. One day what happens, we don't wake up into the same body, right? That's why death is always referred to as a long sleep. So what happens when we really die? Swami says that when we die, what happens is this subtle body, along with withdrawing the senses, also withdraws the prana. So when we are sleeping, what happens is, this is often, this analogy is given, like you have a village, and in that village you have the people sleeping, but you have these fires burning so that the people can be kept warm. So literally the prana is like that, is like those fires. There are five fires which are kept burning in the body, so that the body does not undergo death, so that this Sukshma Sharira can come back into that same body. But when we die, the Sukshma Sharira also withdraws the prana into itself, and when that happens, the body is completely discarded, because that only connection which was there between the Sukshma Sharira and the Sthula Sharira is completely cut off. So why does this happen, and when does this happen? Simply put, this happens when the prarabdha karma comes to a conclusion. And that's another term. So what does prarabdha karma mean? It means that when a person is to be born in a particular body, is supposed to incarnate in a particular body, he chooses from all the karma that he has, all the repository of karma that he has over many births, he chooses the amount of karma that he wishes to work out or she wishes to work out through one particular lifetime, right? That is what happens. So when that choice is made, that becomes the prarabdha karma, and as long as that prarabdha karma is there, this sukshma sharira is attached to one particular physical body. So when that prarabdha is completed, what results is what we call death, where the subtle body completely withdraws from the physical body. And then what happens? I was explaining to you about state of dream, but what happens when we die? What happens when this sukshma sharira completely withdraws from the physical body? Just like I explained about a dream state, something similar happens even after death. And this is not something which is new for us. We all speak of it all the time. What we refer to as heaven and hell, right? Swami goes on to say that there is a lot of karma which is accumulated, good and bad, which has to be dissipated between two lifetimes. Before this karna sharira again incarnates into another body, there is a short period, just like how before we, I have done certain tasks today and I go to sleep, then I come back and continue those tasks. And between these two period of me coming back and waking up tomorrow, this morning, and coming and continuing the tasks, depending on what I have done during the day, that starts playing out in my dream, right? A similar thing happens even between one lifetime and the other, where the sukshma sharira now begins to reap the benefits of its good actions or suffers the consequences of its bad actions in what we call heaven and hell. And heaven and hell is not like how we imagine sometimes, where it is a place where you have done all good, so you end up in heaven for eternity, or you've been such a bad person that you end up in hell forever, ever without redemption. It's not like that. In fact, Swami gives the beautiful analogy of being elected to the parliament, where you canvass, you do a lot of propaganda, and at the end of it, you get elected. But you get elected for a certain period of time. You become a member of parliament or member of the legislative assembly for a period of 5 years. At the end of it, you have to again become a regular citizen and then start again canvassing if you want to go back to that position. So the same thing happens even after death. For a limited period, depending on what good we have done, the punya which we have done, thinking that this I have to enjoy, this will give me heaven. In the past they used to do a lot of yajnas and yagas, thinking that if I do this, I will get a place in heaven. So when we do such activities, we accumulate a certain amount of good actions, or when we very willfully harm others, we accumulate a certain amount of bad actions, because of which we enter into the state of heaven and hell, which is not the ultimate state, which is actually an intermediary between two lifetimes, where for some time this sukshma sharira, where the prana is drawn completely, where the senses are drawn completely. Now the senses, once drawn, probably at this point I should make a mention of that. There is a lot of talk about a subtle body going around and doing things, and the subtle body giving divine discourses, and the subtle body materializing objects and things like that. Swami categorically says that this is not technically correct, because the subtle body, after the moment of death, it completely withdraws into itself all of the senses, which means that this subtle body, the sukshma sharira, cannot see, cannot speak, cannot smell or feel touch and all of these things the way we think that a normal body operates. It's a completely different idea. The idea of the subtle body doing some things like this is actually technically not right. It is not validated by what Swami has said. It is not validated by what is said in Vedanta. But that apart. So at the moment of death, what happens? The prana is completely withdrawn. The senses are completely withdrawn, and this sukshma sharira, with all of its memories of that recent most birth and the memories of all of its birth, goes through this interim period of heaven or hell. And at the end of it, what happens is, this sukshma sharira is withdrawn completely into the karna sharira. Now, what is the jivatma? I told you that there are two things, jivatma and paramatma. So what is this jivatma? Swami says this jivatma is nothing but this karna sharira, which contains in it the sukshma sharira with the memory of all the past births and all of this, the details of all the experiences that this individual soul has gone through. Something like a log in your computer, where, you know, there are these universal logs in our computer which says from the moment the computer was commissioned, all the tasks that it has performed, there's a huge exhaustive log. So something like that, there is a memory of all that we've gone through, and that is contained in the sukshma sharira, and this is withdrawn completely into the karna sharira, and this is what is referred to as the jivatma. The gross is completely discarded. The gross body has got nothing to do with the jivatma. It is completely discarded. It's something like, probably, you know, like a glove that you wear in your hand. The glove has nothing to do with your hand, but once you wear it, the glove seems to be doing a lot of other works. So it's similar to that kind of an idea. So this jivatma is nothing but the karana sharira, and probably this is where I'll just make this point. Swami refers to one more body, which is the mahakarana sharira. We spoke of the sthula, sukshma and karana. Swami refers to another, which is called the mahakarana, which is what we refer to as paramatma. So what we call as karana sharira is still a limited spark of the divine. It is not the complete. But even that state of being in what Swami would refer to as I am, instead of saying I am so and so, I am Prem from Radio Sai, or I am so and so from Canada, I am so and so from London, or whatever it is, you are attaching this I am to a certain personality. From that you come to the point of saying that, oh, I am a soul which has traveled through these births. I've been an engineer, I've been a king, I've been a pauper. So this again is this I am attaching itself to not one body, but to many bodies, to a complete journey. So this is what is referred to as the karana sharira. But when even this I am identification with the soul with journeys completely ceases, this I am attaches itself to the divine principle, where you say aham atma brahma, where you say I am not a jivatma but aham atma brahma, which means this I am is attached to the supreme principle instead of the qualified jivatma, right? So this is what literally happens when we die. So the question the listener asks is, what happens after that? How long does it take for the person to again take a birth? You know, there is no one answer to that. There is not like there is a stipulated time. It all depends on the actions which we have performed when we were alive. That's what Swami says. That the more good you have been, the more wisdom that you would have collected, and the more wisdom that you have, Swami says that the more the choice is with the karna sharira when it wishes to reincarnate. Swami says that there are some very, very elevated people who reach the state where the sukshma is completely withdrawn. It's like the deep sleep state, right? It's a state of bliss. There are individual souls which do not find the need to come back into a body for a very, very, very long time, hundreds of thousands of years. But there are some who for a very short time go into that deep sleep and then immediately come back into a body. Just like probably what happens when we sleep and when we wake up. Some of us who are very restless, who have a lot of things to do, we have a big list of things to do on a weekend, we are not able to sleep, right? We don't get sleep over that night because of thinking of all the things that we have to do the next day. And so we are restless. We spend a very, very short time in the deep sleep and a long time in the dream state contemplating of all these things. Then we wake up early. Sometimes we wake up much earlier than we wanted to, and then we start doing our work. A very similar thing happens after death, when some souls have this urge to again take another body and continue the journey. And Swami says that what makes this body incarnate again and again, it is nothing but desire. desire of every form and every hue and color. It could be a good desire, it could be a noble desire, it could be a craving, it could be a sensual desire. As long as there is a desire to do something, to achieve something, to become something, to learn something, all of this will make this Karna Sharira again give out this Sukshma Sharira and the Sukshma Sharira to look for a suitable body to incarnate in. So this process will keep happening again and again and again and again till the point, as Swami would say, moksha is nothing but mohakshaya. When we come to the point where we completely understand that there is no point in desiring for anything, I am complete as I am, I do not need to get something to make myself purnam. Till that point comes, this body will keep, this soul will keep incarnating again and again and again and again. And when it loses this desire, at this point, you know, different schools of Vedanta have different explanations to give. The Advaita Vedanta, which was propounded by Adi Shankara, which was spoken of by great gurus like Ramana Maharshi and some others, they speak about all that we need to do is reach the state of the Karana Sharira. In fact, in Advaita Vedanta, I believe there are some people who say that there is no concept of the Karana Sharira itself. They speak of the Karana Sharira itself as the ultimate. If you are able to withdraw this Sukshma into the Karana, and if you are able to remain in that state of I am, that is good enough. You know, you have already reached that ultimate state. But of course, Swami says, as I mentioned, Swami speaks about the Mahakarana, which is the Paramatma or the Parabrahman. Swami says that when you withdraw, you are in a state where, you know, you're in a very pure state, where you have complete choice. Do you want to come into the earth? Or, what I mentioned in the beginning of the answer, there are many lokas, there are many, many planes of existence. This soul has even the choice to go higher up into any of those lokas, what we refer to in our Puranas as Vishnu Loka, Brahma Loka, Shiva Loka, and all of that. And I will not go into all of that because, first of all, my knowledge in that is extremely limited. And I think Swami himself has not spoken extensively about that, so I will not be able to go into that. But this is one thing which Swami says, that from the Karana Sharira, you have the choice to go higher. But a few points which are very important to us as spiritual aspirants. One thing is, of course, whatever we go through, we have to eventually keep cutting down our desires, because that is what makes us come again and again in human bodies. That is one thing. The other thing is, as long as we do good actions, even when we are doing good actions, if we think that I am doing good actions, good will come back to me. I am doing this, you know, this is charity I am doing because good will come back to me. I am helping so and so because good actions will bring good results. If you are thinking about the reactions to our good actions and keep doing, Swami says that you will only go up to the level of enjoying some time in heaven and coming back and having a good life in the next birth. But you will not be able to transcend this cycle of birth and death and go to the other higher levels of existence, all the different lokas, or in fact even what we refer to as moksha. So at some point, it is very important, and very beautifully Swami says, one of the best ways to cut this journey short, not cut this journey short, but cut this chain of being born again and again, is start a devotional process of doing whatever you do. Certainly do good, certainly do noble things, certainly do charity, but do it with complete detachment from the fruits thereof. And that can happen if you do it with an attitude of devotion. Swami says you do all your actions, you perform all your duties as a husband, as a wife, as a son, whatever it is, but you keep offering everything at the lotus feet of the Lord and say, God, I've done what I'm supposed to do, and I'm placing it at your feet. I am not interested in the fruits of the action. Willfully giving up the fruits of our good actions is what will eventually stop us from coming back again and again. So this is actually what is explained as what happens when a body dies, undergoes death. But a few other questions that this person has raised, I will not go much into the detail, but I'll make short comments of what has been told. You know, where does how long does it take to the end, to enter into a new subtle body? I explained that, saying that it is not a fixed thing. It depends. Sometimes it is immediate. Sometimes it takes a very, very long time. Is there always a rebirth? Yes, I explained that. As long as there is desire, there will be rebirth. Is there a way to escape it? Yes, it is through the process of completely removing all our desires one by one. And that can be done by doing good actions. This is something which Swami says repeatedly. There is no escape for this. Swami keeps saying, doing good, doing good, doing good. And completely stop doing actions which will hurt others in any form. This is one way by which, in fact, this is one main reason why the body incarnates again and again, to learn this particular way of living, to be able to live without hurting others and to be able to live doing good actions and not expecting anything in return. So does this Atma merge into the Supreme Consciousness? Again, I explained that what exactly it is when the Karana merges into the Mahakarana, which, you know, some believe that the moment the subtle is withdrawn into the Karana, that is done. Some believe that even after that, the soul has a choice. But whatever it is, we will not be able to speak of it. As I said, even the Karana Sharira cannot be explained because it is beyond the mind. The Mahakarana is, of course, completely beyond that. That is why, you know, it is referred to just like how we spoke of the wakeful state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. The Mahakarana belongs to the fourth state, which is called the Turiya. And there is no way one can explain that. Even the state is called Turiya because it's only explained as the fourth state. It's beyond human conception. So whether you believe that merging in the Mahakarana is the ultimate or merging in the Mahakarana is ultimate, what we have to do in the waking state in our day-to-day life is same. Be good, do good, help ever, hurt never. It's as simple as that. There is nothing more complicated than that. To the question, is this Supreme Consciousness Shiva or Narayana or formless, attributeless reality? Well, again, to this, the only thing I can tell is it's, imagine a huge temple which has hundreds of doors. You can enter the temple through any door. And what we call as Shiva, what we call as Narayana, what we call as Jesus, what we call as Allah, what we call as Buddha, all of this is nothing but one of the doors to access the sanctum sanctorum of the temple. So there is nothing like this is what it is. You can, you know, the one who enters through the Narayana door calls the temple a Narayana temple. The one who enters through probably the Allah door is going to call it a mosque. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it is beyond all description, right? So it is not Shiva, it is not Narayana, but it is Shiva and it is Narayana and it is every name that you can attribute to it. And also it is attributeless and absolute. So there is nothing like, I spent my life worshipping Shiva, probably I should have worshipped Vishnu. There is nothing like that because everything literally leads to the same thing. Is it good to worship the souls of our parents or son or for any help? Well, this is an interesting question because this is something which many of us in our families, we see that, you know, somebody passes away, a father passes away, mother passes away, we have their photo in the altar. But going by the explanation which I gave, it's quite possible that the subtle body would have reincarnated in another body because that's what that person says. But then suppose they have taken a rebirth, then what will happen to our prayers? Right? This is a very interesting question. Going by the explanation which we gave, it actually makes no sense to worship a certain person, especially as the body. You keep that person's, a picture of that person's body in your altar and worship that. It actually really makes no sense. It is not that that person has become a deity for the family and will protect you from all of that. No, that is not the case. It is not we worshipping them as God and they protecting us as God. It is not like that at all. It is an expression of the respect that we have for them. It is the expression of the reverence that we have for them. And that is always good. You know, we expressing our love for our parents, for our loved ones and respect. We worshipping our parents. It gives a different benefit. It has got nothing to do with what that soul becomes or that soul merges with God and then it operates like God. I think it's not like that. That is our imagination. But it is nothing wrong in worship, in offering prayers for the departed souls. In fact, that is very, very important. Let me give you a quick analogy of the sleep and the death, which I've been giving all this while. You know, I told you that when we go into that dream state, the senses are completely withdrawn from the body. But we also notice this, that sometimes somebody is dreaming and they are speaking even as they are dreaming, or they are moving their hands around, or some of them even walk in their sleep. This happens because the subtle body has not completely withdrawn all its senses from the body. There is a little bit of, I have no way to explain that, as you know, it happens in stages or it happens immediately, but sometimes it happens that the senses are not completely withdrawn from the body. Something similar to that happens even after death. It is believed that the soul does not completely withdraw from the body. The soul has a certain amount of attachment to the body, to the people around it, and it may find it difficult to move on. And that is why in the Indian tradition we have these worships which are offered the 7th day, the 13th day, and so on. So it is not wrong to worship on behalf of the departed souls. In fact, that is something that is part of our tradition for this very particular reason. And it is also said that this is also why Swami says that you should not have an extended period of grief, because having that extended period of grief makes it more and more difficult for this departed soul to carry on with its journey. In that brief period where it is still not withdrawn completely from the body, it has lived in for 70, 80 years. So that is why they say that extended periods of grief when somebody dies is actually not good for the person who has passed away. So in that sense, that I hope that makes that question clear. We do not worship departed souls thinking that they have become part of God and now they will be able to shower grace on us. I think that is our imagination. Any form of worship, for that matter, when I said that you can worship him as Shiva, Vishnu, probably you're worshipping him with a form of your father or mother. So if that worship is pure, I mean, you get rewarded for the emotion of worship, right? It's not that particular soul has the ability to confer grace on you. That is not the case. So I think that answers all the questions that were asked. So I hope this person is satisfied with the answer we've given. I mean, as I said, this is all what Swami has told on various occasions, especially in summer courses, very, very beautifully explained in some of his Vahinis, what happens to the body, what happens in this process. But you know, the more and more you go into this, it only explains to you, it all comes back to the same things that Swami says, that have less desires, have a ceiling on desires, don't indulge too much in sense gratification, lead a dharmic life, lead a righteous life, do good, be good, and, you know, do everything as a offering to God. Whatever you do, you perform your tasks, your duties at work, at home, in the society, all of that you do it with a feeling of offering to the Lord. It's no different, you know, it only explains this whole Vedantic concept of what happens to the soul after the body is discarded. So I hope it explains everything, and what else can we say, but thanks Swami for speaking on all of these topics and giving beautiful explanations. Probably my explanation was not good enough, but that doesn't mean that Swami has not explained it well. But if it has not been clear, I probably would suggest that you all should go and read what Swami has written on these topics. And as I said, there is much confusion about all of these because of the flood of information which is available in the internet these days. But it is always good to go back to Swami's words, because I completely believe that that is definitely the most authentic explanation for some of these very, very complex concepts. So, dear listeners, it's time to wrap this week's program. If you have a question and you'd like me to answer that on this show, please feel free to write to me. My email ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. I would really appreciate it if the questions are on practical applications of Swami's message, because that is more helpful to all of us we can dwell into Swami's message and see how we can handle our life issues using the message that Swami has given. But if you do have other questions like the one which I answered today, of course, you can feel free. And I would really appreciate if you can send in your questions in your own voice. If you can record it in your own voice and send it, then I can play your question and then answer it. If you wish to be anonymous, you're free to be. The mail ID is my personal mail ID, so the mails that you send there are purely confidential. Most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'll join you in about half an hour with Arvind for the afternoon satsang. But I'll join you all next week at 11 a.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. I'm going to leave you with a very, very beautiful composition of Adi Shankara, which probably speaks of many things which I mentioned today, in the golden voice of the late M.S. Subbalakshmi. I hope you enjoy this. I'll meet you all at 12:30 for the afternoon satsang.
Sarvadharma-swarupine avatara-varishthaya Ramakrishnaya te namaha Bhaja Govindam Govindam bhaja mudhamate bhaja Govindam bhaja mudhamate samprapte sannihite kale samprapte sannihite kale nahi rakshati dukkarane nahi rakshati dukkarane bhaja Govindam Mudha jagi ghi dhanagama trishna Purusat buddhi manasi mitrishna Yalla bhase nija karma patam Yalla bhase nija karma patam Mitam tena minodaya chitam ಮೂಲ ನಿವಾಸ ಶಯ್ಯ ಭೂತಲ ಅಜಿನ ವಾಸ ಸುರ ಮಂದಿರ ತನು ಮೂಲ ನಿವಾಸ ಶಯ್ಯ ಭೂತಲ ಅಜಿನ ವಾಸ ಸರ್ವ ಪರಿಗ್ರಹ ಭೋಗ
ಸರ್ವತ್ರೈಷ ವಿಹಿತ
Bhaja Govindam, Bhaja Govindam.